market.
The S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast where everything old is new again. And no, I'm not just talking about myself or even my new slash old co-host, because drum roll, big announcement, I'm Scott Phillips, and with me again, returning to the microphone, is Andrew Page. G'day, mate. How are you?
We've got the band back together, mate.
The band is back together. Well, the duo, the Simon and Garfunkel, the, I don't know, what else? The Hall & Oates, the Captain and Tennille. I'm not sure. Am I the Captain or you? Actually, they call me the Captain.
Which one's Garfunkel? Tennille,
so let's go with that. Mate, it is fantastic to have you back. Now, I should say for our newer listeners, for our older listeners, Andrew's voice and name will be familiar because you were the original Motley Fool Money co-host, and you're coming back to the microphone, which I'm particularly excited about. A, because you're a good bloke, B, because we're friends, and C, because very occasionally I have something a little bit interesting to say, and I figure we might as well roll the dice on that one. For our older listeners, they'll be happy to hear you back, mate, I'm absolutely sure. For our newer listeners, you won't know Andrew. Andrew, well, he's a former fool, but a full-time friend of the fool. Andrew is no longer with the Motley Fool. You were, mate, for quite a few years. You left to start your own business, strawman.com. Yeah. And the Motley Fool and Strawman are kind of frenemies, right? We're not exactly working in the same, fishing in the same pond, but we're not miles apart either. And I'm, you know, pretty pleased to say we've been able to lure you back to the microphone. There'll be the occasional plug for Strawman, of course. Mate, I'm just excited to have you back to have a chat with every week, which is kind of cool. We are sorry to see Doc go, of course, but we will bring him back from time to time. But in the meantime, mate, I'm just excited to have you back. Let's get the first of what I'm sure is many gratuitous plugs out of the way before we get going, mate. What exactly is strawman.com?
Oh, mate, I thought you'd never ask. Strawman's just it's essentially an online investment club is all it is. And it's one where our members share investment ideas, insights, research by managing virtual portfolios and by curating company reports. And it's been going pretty well. We've got about 17,000 odd users on there at the moment. Nice. We're thrashing the market. So yeah, look, if you want to find some other investors to connect to and you want to see what I'm recommending or what other some really smart investors are recommending and have a look at their portfolio, come and check it out. 100% free.
There you go. Can't get better than that. Mate, the Motley Fool gives investment recommendations. You guys have your members providing their own thoughts on stocks. So we can't, to some degree, there's a bit of overlap there, but we think in a positive way. It's very rare that more isn't better when it comes to investment advice or insights or just shared understandings and learning. So if you're a Strawman member, come and try the Fool. If you're a Fool member, go and duck over, just have a look at strawman.com and see if there are some fellow travellers over there for you to have a chat with as well. Fair to say?
Yeah, thanks, mate. Yeah, look, it's not a million miles apart. I guess the only difference is we're really sort of crowdsourcing our research and recommendations. It's the same kind of thing. And I think the more sources you can get good information from, the better. Hopefully help you make a few good decisions.
I'm going to say too, mate, the more sources you can get good information from, you know, if you were, there are competitors of ours out there who I'd be less keen, I mean, you and I worked together anyway in the past, but there'd be others who I'd be less keen to share the microphone with, but you guys are doing it the right way around. There's a few of us, you guys and some others, but you know, the market's big and there are plenty of people who aren't doing it anywhere near as well or as, I don't want to insult anybody or get myself in trouble, but let's just say,
insult them, mate. No, you insult away. There are a lot of cowboys out there. In fact, the whole raison d'etre, I suppose, of strawmen. And we did it the same at the Fool. It's about accountability. You know, there's scorecards there. There's public track records. And I think, you know, too few people hold themselves to account. So, yes, I think we definitely sing from the same song sheet.
There you go. Let's get on with the podcast, mate, rather than just do a mutual advertising and mutual, you know.
So no, we can keep going with the advertising if you like, mate. No, let's keep going with that.
That's enough about me, Matt. What do you think about me? All right, now let's get on with the podcast. So look, if you are a long-term listener, hopefully you'll join me in welcoming Andrew back to the mic. If you're new or newer and you haven't heard Andrew before, you will enjoy his insights. We're not going to change much about the podcast, quite honestly. As I said, Andrew actually originated the podcast with me. We sat down and did the first one very poorly. I've never, ever gone back and listened to that very first episode, Andrew. And I, for anyone listening, please don't do that because I would be horribly embarrassed, I'm absolutely sure. Here's a dirty little secret. Andrew and I actually scripted word for word that very first podcast and read the back and forth.
Oh my
literally,
God.
It was like a radio play. Like, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, you did this radio play called Molly Fool Money. We've progressed. Let's just say, but by the time Andrew left the podcast, we had progressed and we will retain and go back to that very same
idea. Although I will say, mate, sometimes sometimes the pendulum swung too far. We went from like preparing to, you know, ridiculous degrees to like not preparing at all. So, you know, there's probably a happy middle ground in there somewhere.
Let's assume we've found it, mate. Let's get on with it. Mate, got so much to talk about. Yep. Big macro stuff. Obviously, JobKeeper ending this week was the big one. And man, I'll tell you what, could there have been a worse set of timing, because the Brisbane lockdown literally came the day after JobKeeper finished.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, though, and despite all that, shares apparently on track, if you believe the story in The Australian, for their best year in 8 years. Welcome, but will it happen? Let's find out. We'll talk about some of the top movers too, which are really interesting and might give us a sense of what's actually going on. We'll talk about, speaking of, the other side of that same coin, Platinum, the fund manager. And here's the headline in the AFR. Platinum warns of bloody end to speculative mania. That's not mincing words, so we'll go with that. We're going to have a look at Kogan, mate, at $12. I'm a Kogan shareholder. We have recommended it, Doc and I, to our listeners a couple of times as some of our top stocks. We do a beginning of year stock recommendation, stock ideas kind of, you know, list. That's down to $12 now, and we've had a few people ask us about that, so we'll dig into that. We'll look at AGL, the energy retailer and generator, splitting itself in half, maybe. And, mate, I know you love this. I love this. The listeners love this. We will dip into the full mailbag as well. Let's just get on with it, hey?
Excellent. Hey, do we still do the high horse?
We can, if you got one. You got one?
No, I don't, but I just love the sound effect that we used to have. So no, that's half the reason I came back, mate.
Can I say, well obviously, I can't believe you haven't listened to every single episode is my first concern. I expect, what research did you do for this podcast? Coming back, I would have thought you would have crammed hours and hours and hours of listening to just make sure you're ready for it. But I'm sensing you've done nothing. Is that right?
I did listen to the occasional one, but you know, I don't know.
The bad news is, mate, because we're recording from home these days, the old COVID, the old Zoom phenomenon. We don't have the production values as limited as they were. The single sound effect we used to have, the high horse, has gone by the wayside. You can clap coconuts, you can whinny to your heart's content, mate, but we occasionally do the high horse, but the whinny is gone.
Oh, what a shame.
I know.
Okay. Yeah, it's not the same as being in studio, but we'll make the most of it.
Mate, theatre of the mind. Our listeners can pretend we're in the studio and you can throw out a horse impression anytime you feel ready to. Mate, let's move on to actual news, eh? JobKeeper finished this week, someone up there doesn't like us. I don't know what we've done. Not only did we get stuck with COVID, and then it was supposed to be, I can't wait till 2021, we get this behind us. And now we're 3 months into it, and we're still kind of not having it behind us. As we go to air, mate, France has announced another four-week lockdown. Their third long-term lockdown, trying to deal with COVID over there. So I guess we've got to count our lucky stars, mate, that life here is still pretty good and we've been able to lock down. I don't want to get the politics of it or the, you know, the should we, shouldn't we, but the lockdown's happening in Brisbane. The general view, hopefully, is if this is short, maybe it keeps businesses together, maybe it, you know, it's okay. I'm an optimist, as you well know, our listeners certainly know. I'm hopeful that the growth in the economy, the growth in job ads is enough to start to soak up the jobs lost through JobKeeper and this unfortunate lockdown. But I guess I want to just start with you, mate. We haven't heard from you for a long time about anything like this. Your thoughts on where the economy is, regards to JobKeeper, regards to COVID, how you're feeling about the general economic settings, what you're expecting moving forward.
Oh, geez, mate, talk about launching me into the deep end. That is a very, very big, big question.
Go on.
Look,
tell me about life, universe and everything, exactly.
Well, I think when you talk about the economy at large, I've always had a bit of a bearish bent, and it's something that I've really tried to fight.
Man, you're a downer.
There's something about economic negativity that feels smarter, you know, it feels as though you're being cautious, and there's prudent, always right? something to worry about. Yeah, there's always something out there that's a little bit scary. You'll always find a pundit talking a very compelling bear case. And I guess I've learned to be a little bit more sanguine over the years. I think that rather than trying to get too much into the forecasting with this kind of stuff is just not to play that game, because I can't play it. And frankly, even when you look at the best economists in the world, I mean, they have a pretty horrible record too. So why am I going to play that game? Do you know what I mean? And then having said that, I just sort of take the view that, and maybe this feels a little bit naive, a little bit simplistic, like you say maybe a bit optimistic, that over time we'll generally head in an upward direction and things will improve. And that kind of sort of sets the groundwork for me. But having said all of that, in terms of what might be better called now casting, you know, like, you know, where we are at the moment, I think if you had told me at this time last year that this is what's going to happen on planet Earth over the next 12 months, and yet the market's going to be, well, let's face it, the market is at an all-time high on a dividend adjusted basis, and we should include dividends, right? Like why yeah, would you ignore rent for your investment property? So on a total return basis, we are at a record high. The economy has held up remarkably well. Even things like some retailers and stuff that at first you might not expect, things like, you know, the shaver shop and things like that, which you would think would be absolutely decimated, is everything seems much better than it could have been. And as we go forward, I think JobKeeper is going to be very interesting in terms of how that how things react in the absence of that. I think one of the things that a lot of people forget is that it's a very dynamic thing out there. So I wouldn't be too surprised if this leads to a very big shock. Well, the government will just reintroduce another program, right? I'm generally, color me surprised yet still optimistic when it comes to the economy.
Yeah, I like that, mate. We'll talk more about this and we'll kind of share some of those your broader macro thoughts with our listeners over the time. Look, yeah, I am optimistic. I have to say the growth in jobs has been, it's just been. Governments will take credit for these things because what governments do, but I'll tell you what, you know, don't tell me that in June last year they kind of thought, yeah, March is about the time when jobs will start to come back. That's remarkably unlikely to be the case.
No,
but
no chance.
Yet here we are, and so that's kind of, you know, that's something, right? We are back to, you know, jobs are being created. I have argued on this podcast before. I would have tapered JobKeeper for another 3 months because it's one of those things that because it is reliant on specific data and specific business conditions by business, it's kind of naturally tapering, right? It's one of those automatic stabilizers that the wonks talk about, the boffins talk about. When you no longer qualify, you don't get it. So the amount of JobKeeper does fall over time, but if you still need it, you still need it, which also protects jobs. And there's fair views on both sides of that one, but I have to say I would have given another 3 months just to let that happen by itself. But in the event, I'm still hopeful that, you know, the number of jobs being added, the number of job ads going up online in particular, seems to suggest that businesses are investing, consumers are spending. As long as we keep doing that, and particularly for things like education and tourism, where they're really struggling and will until international arrivals return, that's one area I think probably needs some longer-term support. But, you know, man, as you said, mate, 12 months ago, if you'd said
Free airfares.
Yeah, just about half price at least.
Sorry
to
interrupt. I was going to say, well, the half price airfares or something, which is a whole other kettle of fish. But yeah, I hear what you're saying.
And so, you know, I think you know, to some degree that'll, you know, if you said 12 months ago, here's where we are now, here's what we're back to. Just phenomenal, just remarkable. If you think about just the chance that literally, almost, we're almost exactly, Matt, we're a week past the low point of the market in the wake of the crash. And to be this good 12 months later, it's just a remarkable turnaround. And, you know, whether justified or not, whether forecastable or not, just pretty happy that we're actually in a pretty good place just for all of us, right? You know, our jobs, our businesses, other people's jobs and businesses, livelihoods, well-being, you know, jobs are important. Economic growth and prosperity is important. So pretty happy to have that. Mate, I will.
Can I be a little bit... I think we've got a bit of a lag here, so apologies to the listeners there. Just be a little bit negative for a moment and this has been a longer term trend. I think it's very noticeable in the US, but it's also very noticeable here. Although I think generally at large, the broader average numbers of the economy are looking really good. I'm actually quite worried about there seems to be a widening gap between the rich and the poor. Yeah. I think there's a bit of a structural change there. I think there's also been a bit of a structural change in terms of the type and nature of employment that people have. So yes, we've seen a good recovery there, but it's sort of more part-time, more casual work. You know what I mean? And I think these are bigger structural issues outside of COVID that are going to come to a head sooner or later, and that I don't think get enough attention. But there you go. One little bit of negativity.
No, mate, I think that's right.
It really drives me crazy, mate. Sorry, just like sometimes, you know, you and I are on Ausbiz or things like that, and people talking about, oh, you know, how well COVID held up. You know, we didn't go to the we didn't go to the Swiss Alps this year, but we just went down here. And I just feel, man, that is just said, yeah. like, what bubble are you living in over here? Because the reality is, if you were someone who kept their job over COVID, it was one of the best things that ever happened. You had all this sort of forced savings because you just couldn't go out and spend all of that money.
Yeah.
You still, you know, you had, there was all this sort of stimulus sloshing around. You still had your job, and it was just, it was a wonderful thing. Mm. And a lot of the people in the finance industry, because the markets were doing so well, have done that. So I think we also, when you hear the boffins talk from within these walls, they have sometimes a bit of a view, and it's just like, you really need to go and speak to someone who works at a university or someone who's running a tourist operation or something out there, because it was unlike any other. Usually when there's a recession, you know, to greater or lesser degrees, like, sort of everyone sort of feels the pain. In this recession, it was sort of like a couple of particular sectors just took all of it, and other people actually held up really well. Some, as we well know, even really benefited. So it was really, really, really different in nature. And I think sometimes these broader averages, when we're talking about economic data points, do tend to hide that kind of stuff. And there's a few worrying sort of structural trends underneath all of that, for my money.
No, that's great. I completely agree, mate. I think that's absolutely true. I think some of the longer term trends, by the way, are both pre and post COVID, which is, as you say, that the growing inequality. I think here's the thing, right? I think we get too tangenty too early, but we've only just started. We might as well go with it. Let's go right off piston.
Don't fight it.
Our way back eventually. there is one of the things that really. So this is my hobby horse, right? So most investors think they're long term investors, and so let's put that there. And then they say, but I want tax cuts now. Because I want more money, I want to pay less tax, right? And I don't really care about people who don't have enough money to live on or spend. Okay, fine. And then you say, so where are consumers coming from? Oh, well, the irony is, even if you were just purely self, even if you were the most selfish bastard on earth, right? It makes, in purely self-interest terms, it makes sense to give the poor suckers sweeping streets and cleaning toilets more money to spend so they can buy the stuff that you own as a shareholder, and you can make more money. Even if that was your only objective, over the next 20 years, the more disposable income that goes around the economy, the more money you're going to make. And I'm not saying we should be this selfish, by the way. I think there's an absolute fairness and equity question which needs to be resolved. On a social level, I'm a big fan of it. But even to put that aside, even if you take the most craven view in the world, unless you're going to die in 2 years' time as a shareholder, you want your companies to grow and to be successful in 3, 5, 10, 20 years' time. Guess what, dude? Mm. You want people out there spend. If people have got money to spend, how do you think your company's going to make profits? That, you know, there's only so much they can screw out of current customers or employees. And at that point, someone's going to say,
"Well, mate,
it just drives me nuts." Yeah. Go on.
Well, Henry Ford figured this out, you know, a million years ago.
Yeah, right, he did. You're right.
Do you remember me? Like, the story is that he gave all of his factory workers a big pay rise because they're ultimately the customers, right? So he's just. Anyway, we're getting into ideology there's a big rabbit hole, like, that
it's
I'm going to avoid.
Actually, economic sense. You just the math is speaks for it. You don't have, you know, one of those. You have an ideology, but if it doesn't pass the math test, you don't get to keep it anymore. It just doesn't actually work.
Yeah.
You will literally drive yourself into some sort of, you know, the old profitless prosperity thing of like, hey, I'm rich, but now the companies I own, the share prices are falling. Why are they falling? You look around and go, who can I blame? You got to look in the mirror sometimes. Yeah. Anyway, let's move on, mate. Speaking of share prices going up, headline of the paper, we're recording this on April 1. Happy April Fool's Day, mate. By the time this goes to air, it'll be April 2. So
what an auspicious start. I didn't.
April Fool's joke. This is not going to air at all. Surprise. No, I'm kidding.
Bastard.
So we finished the third quarter of the financial year. Headline of the IFR on track. I've got to say, sometimes, you know, if you're a financial journalist, there are some times of the year where you just go, oh, thank God I don't have to think of a story. You know, end of a quarter, end of a month, end of a year, budget time, you get to go, oh, you know, like, you might love it. But I got to say, I do a reasonable amount of writing, as do you, and you think, what am I going to write about now? What am I going to talk about? It's like, oh, end of the quarter, thank God. Some lucky journos this morning are writing this story. And the headline of The Australian was, stocks on track for bumper year after 3.1% gains for the third quarter. Now, talk of potentially, and this is the first paragraph of the article, Australian shares are on track for their best financial year gain in 8 years, with the benchmark index delivering 15.1% since the end of June as global markets continue to rebound from the depths of the pandemic. Now, I don't know about you, mate. I'm pretty allergic to taking 9 months of data and then forecasting a year-end position. You and I have been around this rodeo a couple of times already. We kind of know how this works. I'm not even saying they're going to jinx it, although I'd also be worried about that personally. But man, calling the year after 9 months, that's pretty aggressive.
It is, and it's just stupid as well, right? I mean, I don't know how many times they do it because it's very clickable, and that's a whole other ball of yarn that we won't get into. But it's just I don't know how I've been in this game for 20 something years now, and you just see this thing again and again and again and again, and just materially wrong all of the time. And then when they are right, I think it's just purely because of luck, but. So it tends to make me roll my eyes in a very big way. And I also think, well, who gives a stuff? You know, whether the market goes up 20% or down 20% in the next 3 months, I know this sort of sounds a little bit trite, but if I had a choice between the two, give me a 20% fall any day, right? Like I'm still – this is being selfish here. I'm still in an accumulation phase. I'm putting money to work. I want cheaper prices. Let it fall, you know?
Yeah. I think that's you will be not alone amongst our listeners, but there'll be plenty of people who don't like that idea. But and yet, the maths is also speaking of maths is also pretty true, right? If you're still accumulating,
well, think about it.
You want low prices for longer, so you can accumulate at cheaper prices, as long as those prices recover at some point. If prices stay low, you're not doing yourself any favors.
Well, this is. Yeah, this is the distinction that I think it's a lot of us fail to grasp, even though it's not that difficult. But you know, shares are not the business. I mean, that's something get tattooed on your arm. You know, shares are not the business. So I'm not saying I want my businesses to suffer a 20% fall in their fundamental intrinsic value or their cash generation. I want a business that just continues to sail on very nicely, thank you very much. But which the market, because it's in a bit of a tizzy, has decided to give me a bargain price. For by freaking out about what's going to happen in the next 3, 6, 12 months.
Right now, I'm pretty glad that our listeners are realizing that we've replaced one friendly curmudgeon with another one. So, Doc, we miss you, but Andrew, you're filling the void nicely, mate. It's a good start to the new
old era
of podcasting Motley for Money. All right, the thing I want to talk about now is. I desperately hate, as you do, cliches in the market, right? I just, whenever you throw a cliched word or a bit of jargon, it's almost cover for having to actually explain the issue, right? More buyers than sellers. Okay, cool. Yes. Hang on. That being said,
that doesn't make sense.
The rotation word is kind of ugly and I hate it, but it's kind of true, mate. So let me give you a list. Again, sourced from The Australian. These are the top movers in the ASX 200 over the last 3 months, right? Now, some of these aren't exactly all in the same vein, but let's go through it. Linus up 55%, Virgin Money 45%, Zip 39%, so one new economy company, tick that box. Codan, the metal detector maker, up 38%, News Corp 36%, Vocus 34%, Nufarm, let's make some fertilizers, 30%, Incitec Pivot, Explosives 28%, Elders, Rural Services 26%, and Westpac. Up 26%. Mate, given what we saw through the back end of 2020, I don't like the word rotation, but gee, if there's a definition of it, it's that, right? There's one new economy. Vocus is kind of mostly takeover talk and stuff. Other than that, there's only one new economy company in that top 10. And when you can put, you could have written this list in 1985 and seven of those companies would have been there and you would have gone, yeah, no, they're the usual suspects. Westpac, Elders, Instec Pivot, Nufarm, News Corp, Codan, Linus. You're kind of going, okay, well, that seems, what internet? You know, even Virgin Money is kind of, it's a financial services company. You can kind of lump that in. You get to eight. It's fascinating that, when the market does change its mind for justified reasons or other, and maybe this goes back to the point you were making before, there really is it's very hard to fight the wave in the short term. You know, right now, tech is on the nose. Yeah. The old economy companies that were to some degrees left for dead during the COVID comeback. You know, this is vaccines out. This is to some degree maybe just normalization. But it's also really hard to avoid the simple reality that, you know, rotation or otherwise, it is those old economy comeback companies that have done well over the last quarter.
Yes, but I'm with you, mate. I hate it. I hate it with a passion, this talk.
Except it's true. That's the only problem.
Lack of context. Well, it's true, but it lacks context. So when you were rattling off those lists, I was busy plugging away into my computer here just to check some of the performances. So New Farm, for example, oh, what a great performance that has been, you know, up, you know, gazillion percent in the last 3 months. Yeah. Mate, it's at the same share price it was 10 years ago, right? And there's others, there's plenty of others in that category as well. So there are these narratives that drive certain behavior. I remember a little while ago it was the rotation from growth back into value, and now it's the rotation from, you know, new to old, and it's a bunch of fund managers creating this kind of narrative, and I think it washes away against the broader tides of history and the broader forces and dynamics that are at play. I know it sounds very smart, and don't forget, the industry is geared around making you act. No one makes any money if you buy a bunch of shares and chuck them in the broader drawer, right? So you need to be rotating into this and out of that. You need to be trimming this. You need stop loss orders. You need all of these kinds of things which are purely designed to make you trade, and trading is hazardous for your wealth. So I really roll my eyes at all of these kinds of things. And you know what? Maybe this trend goes on for another 3 months. I'm not buying New Farm. You could point a gun at my head, and there's no way I'm going to do that. Mm-hmm. I just think that it's trying to make a story out of something that isn't there. And you look back at those past rotational narratives that were out there. No one talks about them anymore. Even ones from last year are completely ancient history, and this one will be too. So I know getting quite ideological for the first time back here, but it's just sort of like, I just think, you know, forget all of this stuff that sounds so smart. It is really boiling it down to just find some really great companies at attractive prices, buy, and then hold for as long as you possibly can. It sounds too simple to be true, and it's a process that does require that you sit through very uncomfortable periods of up and down and the rest of it, but it's the smartest way to go. So any talk of this kind of stuff really just gets my blood boiling. I think it's just journalists and fund managers trying to be smart, you know, and they're not. They're actually, if you think about it for half a second, these are stupid things to do. And the other point is as well, one more thing and another thing, when by the time this stuff is hitting the news, we've seen that 30, 40% jump in these companies. Yep. And sort of like, well, now that you're hearing about, also now after a 40% re-rate, now's the time I'm going to buy in, because I'm just going to extrapolate that trend forward for the next 3 months. You know, on what every percent that a security goes up reduces your future return potential. It is an inverse relationship. Higher prices equals lower returns, all else being equal. So it's sort of like, it's something which is played out. You've probably missed it a big chunk of that, and it's becoming less and less and less attractive as it goes forwards. And it's all driven on something that may or may not last any meaningful period of time.
So I said friendly curmudgeon. I'm going to have to rant over angry curmudgeon instead. mate, no, I think you're right. Although, look, I will say, just for the sake of argument and just for the sake of, you know, whether it's rotation or not, you know, some holders of these companies will have been saying, hey, these things were too cheap on January 1 and I bought them because the market had left them for dead. They'd forgotten about them. These companies were worth buying, and this is, you know, they may argue, the point you're making, which is they did go and buy these companies. Those who enjoyed those gains, who've held them since January or December or February, bought them specifically because they expected these businesses to be worth more, and that the market was actually ignoring them during that kind of, you know, post-vaccine, you know, whatever we want to call it. you know, we'll leave the cliches and the jargon out, but you know, there is some sense of like this is evidence of exactly that, right? People looking around. I mean, Codan, News Corp, New Farm, they're hardly, you know, sexy tech stocks or momentum stocks. These are just kind of, investors looked around and went, hey, these look too cheap to ignore. I'm going to buy some. And if that was the case, they've done pretty well.
They absolutely have, but it's more of what we're talking about. The danger is that this is an historic record of what has happened in these shares. And I think it's not
a buy list, is it?
Very subtle. Yeah, exactly. But we're all driven by sort of FOMO, and we're all driven by these trends and all that kind of stuff. So I would say, I actually think it highlights the point really well. There were some smart investors out there, had done a lot of research, understood these businesses, identified value, and then acted. Now, sometimes it takes a while for that thesis to sort of be borne out. In this instance, it's 3 months, and fantastic to them. They might be the same people who thought, hey, look, these shares are about 30% undervalued and are now selling that their investment case has been realized. So I guess that's the distinction that I would make. It's not that they necessarily did anything dumb or wrong. Clearly they've made money. My issue with it is that these headlines sort of go out there, and it almost sort of suggests that this is the smart play. This is what you need to be doing as well. And that's the issue that I have a problem with. I would actually say, take the lesson of these other guys. They bought them when the share price, because until it hit that bottom, it was falling, right? Yeah. That's when they were buying. So look for that again. Look for a company that's fundamentally undervalued. It might be falling. You might buy it. It might continue to fall. But if you get that valuation part right, it will out. Maybe not always in 3 months. In fact, certainly not always in 3 months, but that's the process. That's the lesson that you want to take from this. I'm just going to expect this momentum to continue in this particular space and under this particular narrative.
Done.
For now.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, so let's take the other side of this, because we talked about some of the big winners. On the flip side, tech has had a really, really tough 3 months. Afterpay hit a 3 month low earlier this week. Just zips up 40%, by the way. So I'm not gonna dare wonder whether there's a rotation between those two stocks, because I'll set you off again for another rant. I'll avoid that. But tech is on the nose, mate. And to add what's the phrase? Fuel to the fire. Platinum, the fund manager, out there saying, well, the warning of a bloody end, as I said earlier, to the speculative mania in high growth tech stocks. They are saying that there's worse to come despite the last 3 months. I'm going to quote, is it Andrew Clifford? Andrew Clifford from Platinum. Quote, "The speculative mania in growth stocks will end badly for those who stay too long, just as it did in the tech bubble." Shades of 1999, he's conferring here. Quote again, "and countless other speculative manias." When you hear people say it's not like the 2000 tech bubble, I must say I agree. But here's the killer punch. This is a much bigger bubble, says Andrew Clifford. They are fighting words, mate. And look, the NASDAQ fell, 80% post-tech bubble in 1999? If this is a bigger bubble, you can only assume that the losses he might predict, I won't put words in his mouth, but if it's a bigger bubble, if it's blown up bigger, it's got further to fall almost by definition. With tech stocks already on the nose, Clifford's doubling down here. Is he right, mate, or is he missing the point?
It's actually that question, I think, has been around for a little while now, and I actually think it's got a lot of merit. The hard thing with this discussion is that we have to generalize. We're talking about tech shares. And within that generalization, I would argue that there have been some really wonderful tech shares that have done really great lately. Alcidion's done really well for us on Strawman, just to put another quick plug in there. So again, you've got to take that view. But yes, there. I thought Afterpay at $150 was insane. Right. And people would come back and they would say, oh, but, you know, earnings are going to grow really strongly. And it would get to you get to some of these situations with these tech companies where you can actually say, I agree. They're going to grow their earnings at this huge rate for a very, very long time. But as Charlie Munger is fond of saying, no company is worth an infinite price. So is Afterpay worth $1 a share? Well, clearly not. Is it worth $10,000 a share? Well, clearly not. Now, just purely by logic, you would then say, well, therefore, between $1 and $10,000, there is a price that is sensible and properly accounts for the cash generation ability of this business longer term. As attractive as that may be, and I think that there are a lot of companies out there where they have just been driven up by a lot of hot retail money, by an absence of any compelling other investment alternatives for the bigger end of town. by actually a realization, I think the market took a while to sort of fully realize the attractiveness of a lot of these business models and their market opportunity and their ability to scale, and just how brilliant and dominant these businesses have the potential to be in the future. Right. But I agree. I think we've got to a point for a large part. A lot of this has sort of been factored in and then some. So the proposition, even if you retain a very positive outlook on the company itself, I feel as though you're in a situation where there is more downside than upside. So in other words, things go swimmingly well for all of these companies from here, and I'll probably get a decent return. Not, you know, even a reasonably attractive one. But if they don't, there is very serious downside. And in that regard, there's a real asymmetry in my return prospects. So I want a business proposition, an investment proposition, where there's less downside than upside. And I feel as though that's a little bit flipped in this space at the moment.
I like that, mate. So, if you were going to guess on a category level, on a sector level, does tech outperform from here, or is it pretty well priced? Is it overpriced? I know you're saying it's company specific, and you're absolutely right. But let's go back to Clifford's kind of assertion. He's making a really, really, really big call here, and a very generic call, the exact opposite to what you're trying to do, which is the right thing, which is add a bit of nuance, which is actually investable rather than just big headlines. But yeah. I mean, this is not. Clifford's a smart bloke, and he also, smart as in intellectually smart, he also frankly knows that a call like this is either going to make or break, or not make or break Platinum, but you know, he'll be remembered for this call whether he's right or wrong. Is tech overvalued? Is it cheap? Is it fairly valued? If someone said to me, look, do I buy a tech ETF, whether that's a NASDAQ ETF or an Australian tech ETF, there's the Australian All Technology Index, for example. You know, do you have a thought? Which way would you go on tech? Is it cheap, expensive, or the old Goldilocks about right?
Well, actually, I'm keen for your opinion too, mate. So I feel as though I'm doing all the answering here, but I'll give you my two cents. Is I think it is expensive, but I also think it's very. Some of these analogies aren't very good. I was working in this sector in 1999 in the first tech bubble. It was very different. Yes, it was all about tech, but none of these, we didn't really have proven business models. Lord knows we didn't have cash flows. It is very, very, very different this time around. So I think you've actually got very real, strong, attractive businesses for the main that are in play here. So I don't think that when you don't have a business, what was it? Pets.com or something like, there's just nothing there. You are going to see these massive downside when the bubble pops. If you're a business that's like, you know, I know, let's stick with Afterpay. You're growing at an incredible rate.
Yeah.
A very attractive sort of business. Yeah, it was overvalued at $150 and wow, it's fallen 30%. Maybe it could fall another 30%. But I still think there is something there, and the downside isn't as potential. So to get more specific, I do own a bunch of tech ETFs. In fact, that's how I get exposure to the US market. It's just I prefer to focus stock specific in Australia. And I see this concern, and I think that it's valid, but at the same time, I come back to my approach, and my approach is I'm a man in his middle 40s. I'll be working for a long time yet. I know that I'll be saving up money as I go. So sometimes I'll be investing when it's high. Sometimes I'll be investing when it's low. But I know that the golden rule of compounding, and compounding is just the most beautiful thing on the planet, is that the rule there is don't interrupt it. And you know me, mate. You've seen me firsthand make these dumb mistakes before, where you try and get a bit too clever with timing the market, and you realize that in the great arc of history, the person who just sat tight and just dollar cost averaged into the market over time does spectacularly well. So I think those concerns are valid, but it doesn't change what I'm doing one iota. What do you think?
I like it, Matt. I think that's, and look, as always, that's the right approach, right? I think the general kind of views. I've been known to make, I don't make predictions. I have said in the past, I think tech was, and I think probably arguably is still overvalued at a not even a sector level, because Afterpay is so big, frankly, that your view on Afterpay is your view on tech. So it's almost, on the Australian market, it's hard to have a summary view without having an Afterpay view, and then no matter what everything else does, Afterpay will determine the future there. So that's always a little bit tough. But I think it's worth just having a think about where that actually nets out for an investment perspective. I think that's the kind of you know, that's the key one. But I do worry a little bit about thoughtless multiples being paid for stuff. I'm not even sure that you won't necessarily do well with a basket of tech stocks or tech in air quote stocks, but just be a little bit careful. Don't buy arbitrarily. On the flip side, I think there's going to be some bargains. I think that's also true. I don't really see – so what I will say is I don't see – I can't see Platinum's angle, quite honestly. Like I just don't think – particularly anything bigger than the tech bubble. I mean, again, if you follow that through to the implication, I can't see it being true that these companies as a group are likely to – well, I won't say not likely to fall. Anything could happen, right? But I don't think they're overvalued by 5, 6, 7, 8 times, which would be required for a fall of 50, 60, 70, 80% to be reasonable, unless Clifford's just purely market timing, which he may be, and not really looking at the fundamentals. But Platinum tends to be a reasonably fundamental-based investor. I'd be surprised if he's not saying this at a fundamental level. I don't see the gap, I have to say. I wouldn't be putting my whole lot in tech for the sake of tech. By the same token, the irony, of course, is Pets.com is now owned by Amazon and was actually a really great idea. It was just too early for its time, which is the other problem, right? And I know Mark Andreessen, the famed venture capital in charge of Andreessen Horowitz, has said that none of the ideas in the tech boom were wrong. They were just early. Almost every one of those ideas has actually just come to pass in the fullness of time, which is also kind of quite a cool thing looking back. But being wrong, as we know...
Any bubble has a nugget... It's so true, mate. Yeah. And every bubble has a nugget of truth to it, and you know, that's they look silly in hindsight, but they're not that silly at the time. So, yeah. I was going to do that segue because that seems like a good segue to make because that is a retailer. But let's face it, I would actually say it's a tech sort of oriented one. And it was one that I had a quick look. I haven't had a look at it for a while. Actually, the last time we chatted about this, I think I was giving some bear case on this very podcast 4 years ago.
You're probably right, you bastard.
And you know what? I was right for a little bit, and I remember thinking I should send Scott a bit of "I told you so." And of course, I think then it went to like to get $25 or something. another lesson for me there. But at that level, it was at a price earnings multiple of 90. So maybe that's an example of what we're sort of talking about here. Business that factually it performed extraordinarily well. Their earnings doubled on a per share basis between 2018 and 2020. Yeah. It's forecast to do that again between now and 2022.
And yet, mate, maybe things just got a little bit carried away. The P is 26 times. If that's right, if that forecast is right, they do double earnings again, that'd be a 2022 P of 13 times for a retailer. I'm massively biased, right? I'm a shareholder. The company for Share Advisor, the service that I run. I've done it on this podcast. You know what? Kogan's PE, mate, get this, less than Woolworths. Now, I'm not saying Kogan is Woolworths. I'm not saying it's safe or as secure or as stable or as well known or as established as any of that.
That is stupid, mate.
I almost don't have the words to describe a scenario where it's probably about the same PE as Commonwealth Bank, I would guess. It's cheaper on a PE basis than Woolies. Now, you know, Kogan's going to have a tough year this year. Maybe, I don't imagine profits decline, but, you know, they're coming off the back of a 2020, which was obviously COVID-induced, and we know that, you know, online retail is spectacularly well. Let's assume it even does nothing. Let's assume profits flat this year and then doubles again next year or grows again by 30% next year or something. You're paying the same amount for Kogan as you're paying for Woolies, which is going to grow its earnings at, I don't know what, mid-single digit per year over time if it's lucky. I can't work this one out.
Well, this is where I need my Foley artistry skills to get the high horse intro going. But mate, I 1,000% agree. Woolies makes no sense to me whatsoever. As much as I think it's a killer business, it's just a very mature one. It's not going to grow. There is a trade-off in investing that has always been true and always will be true. And it's often poorly phrased as risk equals return, which suggests if you take a lot of risk, you'll get a lot of return. What it's really saying is that if you want very high return, you have to take a higher risk.
Yeah.
And you know, you've got two companies here, both trading at the same kind of multiple. Yes, one is a bit more risky than the other, but it's not a hyper speculative company. Mm-hmm. It's one that's earning money, and it's one that's forecast to grow incredibly strongly. So I don't want this to come across as a recommendation. I haven't looked at it closely for a while. I need to do some due diligence on it. But based on those numbers there, a very important data point for me is that you like it. So I can lean a little bit on your insight. But it does seem strange. Having said that, though, here's the lesson, and it's a lesson that we've had 100 times before, and it's a lesson that we've had with Kogan before as well. Yeah. It's how many times has it had this huge run up and a massive fall off? Yeah. Like you would know as a shareholder, but I can think of at least 3 or 4 times that's happened. I think the problem is that you get a lot of people, a lot of retail investors, private investors who sort of look at that and realize it, but then sort of say, oh, well, I'll wait for it to start going up and then I will buy, which sounds eminently sensible, yeah, right, of course. Right. Of course, you know, bottoms are only apparent in hindsight. Yeah. Yeah. So I would tend to suggest the smart way to play this, if that's what you're wanting to do. And again, this is not advice, but just a general lesson for anything of this kind of nature is that if it's at an attractive price according to your calculus, you know, start accumulating. If it drops further, accumulate a little bit more. Just average that in. You are not going to care if this drops another 15% before then doubling. You're not going to care. And so I think that's the cautionary tale I would give for people looking at this situation. You might be right in your overall analysis, and if you are, don't worry too much about the timing. Timing tends, in my humble opinion, tends to be a waste of time.
Yeah, I think that's... I still can't work out the Kogan Woolworths thing. I can't work out what assumptions you have to make for the combination of those two businesses. Pay less.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
I'm not even saying that Woolies isn't just stupidly overvalued and Kogan's also a little bit overvalued. All I'm saying is the same market thinks Woolies is worth paying 27 or 28 times for and 26 times for Kogan. And if you put, I can't imagine anyone who, even if you say, look, Kogan's a reasonably ordinary business and maybe only grows profits at 10% a year for the next 20 years, that's still better than Woolies. I don't know how you put those two together and come up with that answer. Like, I genuinely... Yes, there's different people in the market. The market is an amorphous group, and there's people who will pay more for Woolies because it's Woolies and all that kind of stuff. But when some people tell you it's an efficient market, I'm going to hold that up and I should have that framed as, you know, whatever happens from here, there is no reasonable assumption that you can hold both those thoughts in your mind at the same time without your head exploding. It just doesn't work, does it?
Well, we've talked about this duality before, which is really tricky as an investor. If you view the markets as efficient, well then just buy an ETF, right? There's no point being a stock picker. And if you don't view the markets as being efficient, and I think we see lots of examples of massive inefficiency, and thank God for it, because that's what gives us opportunity. You can't then turn around and go, hey, why is the market, I must be wrong, I'm missing something here. And it's like, well, maybe you're not. And that's the really hard thing. You need to be the kind of person who's confident enough to say, I am right, the market is wrong. And then swim against the tide, but also at the same time hold in your head that recognize that, you know, over time the market will be right, and it might be that you that's wrong. So it's this, you know, you need this humility when investing, where you can, you know, take your medicine, understand when you've made a mistake and walk away, but still you need the arrogance to assume that you're going to be smarter than the market. It's a really interesting dynamic.
It's a remarkable time to be alive, mate. Continuing still. 2021 was supposed to be a normal year, mate. We haven't got there yet. Let's finish off company news. Just with the AGL news, mate. I wanted to raise this for a couple of reasons. I've been speaking more regularly, more recently, about the idea of, even if you're not someone who invests with an ethical perspective, knowing that the market can take those views is important. Even if you're someone who doesn't believe in the science of climate change, I'm on record as saying I think that's wrong. I think climate change is real. I think the science is pretty clear. But anyway, even if you're not, ignoring that, it can also be a mistake. And exhibit A, B, or C is probably AGL right now. AGL is planning to split itself into two parts, or at least, now whether they split formally or just simply report the business units differently, those things are yet to be fully rolled out. AGL is currently an integrated retailer and energy generator. Generator as in they have coal plants and wind turbines and solar farms and stuff. They generate the electricity and then their retail business sells theirs and other energy as a branded reseller, a bit like the NBN kind of resale structure, to consumers. Now,
it's AGL's, it's a Gentailer.
Oh, yeah. Did you love those?
Don't you love that one?
That's good, isn't it? if you've got to make up a new word for it, there's very. It's like Treasury Wine says with their mastige brands of mass and prestige.
Oh,
if you've got to whack a word to get you in trouble. Now. It reminds me, of course, of Tomcat. Remember Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes? Tomcat? They put that together as well. What was the J-Lo? That was Jen J. I can't remember anyway. Benifer.
Ben Affleck and the wrong guy.
Whatever her name was.
Benifer, that's right. Yes.
Clearly, our grasp of pop culture is top notch, dude. I've given you references that are at least 5 years old, which tells you exactly what I know about pop culture.
Longer, right there.
mate, it's just interesting because, you know, so they're going to split their business, they're going to separate the two businesses internally at least, and maybe sell them off to try and recognize some value because AGL has realized it thinks, it realizes, there's no proof of any of this stuff, right? But, you know, reading the tea leaves, they're trying to separate themselves into those two businesses, a green, in air quotes, retailer and an energy generator. They're calling internally Prime Co. You'll love that. Whenever the investment bankers get involved, someone's got to have Co. There's New Co and there's Prime Co. And BHP spin off of South 32 had a, I think it was Crap Co, I think was the way that there was probably a less radio friendly word they used to use, but we'll go with Crap Co. They love putting a co at the end. It sounds somehow cooler. So this Prime Co business is basically the generation assets. And their argument is this carbon neutral green retailer that people can buy shares in is one business. And this dirty coal kind of, you know, with some wind and some solar just to kind of green it up a little bit is a different business. And they're going to try potentially to split those off. Here's the thing, though. They're not sure if they can find enough buyers for PrimeCo.
Yeah.
They're basically, if we do this, then, hey, the retail business will be super cool and sexy and people will love it, but we may not be able to find enough people to actually buy the generation assets because such is the policy uncertainty and general investor distaste. And we've seen that with protests about bank funding of coal mines. We've seen BlackRock come out and basically say, if you don't have a plan to reduce carbon, we're out of here. It's a really interesting combination.
Yep. The AGL is super smart to do this. They're thinking long term. They know the writing's on the wall. You watch a bit of Sky News, and you might think that some of these doubts are stronger than they are. But this is absolutely a stranded asset. It's just a matter of time. And when you've got there's a lot of smart investors out there that are staying a mile away for that for very, very, very good reason. And so AGL has to make a move. I think probably it's smarter to just get what you can for it. Don't worry about getting too attractive a price and just get it off somewhere else. It is something. It sounds like I'm coming across as like a ultra extremist greenie or something like that. I think it's just economic sense. You know, these assets last for decades and we're at a point, mate, like it's just like whenever I get into a bit of an argument with some of my mates about this stuff, it's just sort of like the environment's like the last part of the equation to even talk about. It really just gets to economics. When you can generate electricity for a lower cost per unit and you can do it without all these dirty mines and cap, just why? And this is what AGL is thinking, right? So I think they're smart to do it. I wish them well, but I certainly wouldn't be going anywhere. The investment bankers can call it Prime Co, they can call it Gold Co, they can call it whatever they want. I am not going anywhere near that thing.
You sound pretty sure.
Here's a fascinating story, and I know you've heard this one before.
Go on.
But one of the better performing companies over the last 30 years, this is actually going back 5 or 10 years, so you know the 20, 30 years before that was Altria, which was a tobacco company.
50 years
now,
it
you
was.
Could have a 50. Yeah, you know the story better. So it's 50 years ago. Why is that? Now, over that time, what is fascinating is that smoking rates have fallen precipitously.
Yep.
So how does the shares perform so well? Well, it turns out that they saw the writing on the wall as well. They pulled back every single cent of unnecessary capital expenditure and investment. They had this machinery that just did basic maintenance on all of that kind of stuff. And they ran these businesses for cash. So any free cash that came out of that, they paid to it, to investors. That's where the return came from.
Yep.
The trouble with that is it's extremely rare. There's a lot of arrogance and ego that's involved, and there'll always be some genius out there who thinks he can turn it around and bring smoking back or bring coal back or something like that. If AGL, whoever ends up running this Primeco business, is smart and they run it in that fashion and you get enough of a discount, that it might be something. I would actually have no ethical problem investing in it, but I do think it's a risky proposition.
I think you're right. I'm a little more sanguine than you are, at least a little bit more open to the chance this actually might be worth investing in for the reasons you talk about and the reasons that if it's distasteful enough to invest in right now because of coal, these coal-fired power plants will come to the end of their useful lives, and AGL will replace them with, in all probability, renewable assets. And so Primeco, that looks currently like this stranded asset, as you rightly point out, is not a coal mine, it's coal generation. And yes, the assets themselves, they won't be able to refurbish or reopen these power stations. They have, finite lives, as we know. And in fact, I think it might even be AGL. One of them is actually bringing forward the closure of one of their plants in Victoria by 4 or 5 years because of this idea. It's not worth reinvesting in. I'm not convinced that AGL won't have, by the way, some sort of, or the Primeco business won't have some sort of future. I will actually be looking at it. I've got to be careful not to be too contrarian for the sake of it, not to want to be true. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if you found an asset that, or a business, sorry, that had a range of assets, and as they rolled off coal, they were able to roll into solar or wind or thermal or tidal or something. If you said to me, you've got to own a coal generating plant, nothing else for the next 40 years, I'd say, well, no thanks. But I don't know, mate. I will reserve judgment. We'll probably come back to it at some point and have a look. But I just thought the idea is worth looking into. And as you rightly say, mate, the concern for investors should absolutely be, what does this business look like? And are they smart enough as a management team to either run them for cash or to pivot the business fast enough and quick enough to take advantage of those tailwinds? Or do you end up in 15 years' time going, man, Primeco, what a dog, hey? Like it had declining returns 15 straight years, and now there's nothing left, and who could have seen it coming? We'll all go, well, all of us. But I'm not ruling out the possibility that in the right hands it might be worth something if the shares.
I agree with that. It's not impossible. I would say this though is that when you're transitioning like that, you've got to ask, well, what competitive advantage do you have in this space? You're talking about an industry that's extremely, even moving to renewables, extremely capital intensive. There's going to be a lot of other generators there. What makes you so special that you'll be able to get bigger market share or better margins or any of this kind of stuff? I mean, it's different when there's only sort of, so many coal plants around and you've got like an oligopoly of sorts that are there. There are now communities that are throwing up their own solar farms and stuff like that. So what I wonder in the new energy economy, when there is far lower barriers to entry, it doesn't mean that AGL can't or Primeco can't survive. It doesn't mean that they can't pivot to that, but they're probably not going to be getting super high margins. You know what I mean?
It's going to make it work, right?
Exactly. So again, Buffett's always talking about looking for 1 foot bars to step over. This is a 6 foot bar to high jump over. Yeah, and it's just like, why do it? It might work. It's not impossible, but why take the risk when there's so many better propositions out there?
Yeah. No, I like that. I like that a lot. All right, mate, let's finish off as we want to do with a quick dip into the Motley Fool mailbag, mate. This is one from Craig, and I'm gonna assume Craig meant it with a straight face. I'm gonna relay it with a straight face. I'm gonna hopefully not get kicked off the air. So let's go with this. Craig says, "Hi Scott, and new great wise one." Man, didn't know you were coming, did he? we'll assume he did. "I am lucky enough," says Craig, "to have a few stocks in my portfolio that have gone up heaps. Even though I think they could be ridiculously overvalued, I'm reluctant to sell, as I would have to pay capital gains tax. Throwing a bit of FOMO. And I wonder how much capital gains tax plays a part in stocks becoming overvalued and staying overvalued," which I quite like. So he's reluctant himself, but his question isn't so much, he's recognized that in himself, but he's saying, hang on, what if it's possible that in the market at large, do capital gains themselves and the desire not to pay tax, or simply to get caught up in the story of, I'm smart, I've made money, therefore I'm still smart, therefore I'm going to keep making money, does that in itself keep stocks higher than they otherwise might have been? What are your thoughts, mate?
That's a that is an excellent question, Craig.
It's a cool idea, isn't it?
It is a really good idea. The truth is, I don't know. It's an interesting proposition. I would take a slightly different tact and say this to you. never, ever, ever, ever let tax. Yeah, well, don't let tax is like the last consideration. Yeah. So you want to do everything within your power to minimize your tax, and I think that's part of being a long term investor is you get that 50% capital gains discount. So absolutely, but if something is no longer a good proposition, or if something is as in his words, ridiculously overvalued, mm-hmm. I don't think it's better to have a huge tax bill and make a heap of money than to you know see it fall back and have a lower tax bill. I've said this to you in the past, mate. If I was to find out this year that I owed the ATO $10 million, I would be the happiest person on planet Earth. The only way I can pay heaps of tax is to earn heaps of money. So I will do everything sensible in my powers to minimize that, but at the end of the day, it shouldn't be a major decision. It shouldn't be the most important decision. And yeah, I know right. Craig's not saying that, but I just wanted to put that out there.
No, I think you're right.
What do you think?
Well, I think that's right. He's not saying that, but I you know what? I think there's something to that. I think if you look at, you know, you and I, you've been banging on about banks longer than I have, and again, as our resident curmudgeon, you're equally as disappointed with the banks or unhappy with the banks as Doc was. So we got some continuity in the podcast, which is encouraging. I'm not a smart guy,
Doc, wasn't he?
I'm not massively bearish on the banks, but I'm not a fan. I wouldn't be buying them. But I do wonder. I mean, that whole idea, whether it's capital gains tax or just gains in general. You know, banks are popular because, yeah, the dividend yields are nice, but I do wonder how much of the fact, well, I've made this much money since the IPO, of course I'm going to hold them. If you bought Westpac at $2 or Commonwealth Bank at $2, whatever the prices were listing, and then now, you know, in the 80s for Commonwealth Bank and whatever Westpac is, I'm absolutely sure that that's become a self-fulfilling prophecy. The people are like, well, I'm not selling it. You're looking at the banks going to make me money, yeah, but I'm not selling them because look how much money I've made. I think there is a sense of it's actually proven in people's minds its own success. I actually think the question is valid. I think there is a very much a case of, hey guys, look how well I've done. You want me to sell now? Are you kidding? Look at the success of the banks over the last 40 years. And I think that both can be true, right? Just because they've been successful doesn't mean they will continue to be as successful. We've been right over the past few years, by the way, and the banks, they've gone almost nowhere. And that's, that's cost some people some potential gains. But I think he's onto something, quite frankly.
It's a case in point. Yeah. It's a case in point, isn't it? Because I remember when we were talking about it back in the day, you know, it's sort of like there is so much. I come across people all the time. They're just, I don't want to sell because I bought CBA at $4 and it'd be. And so Craig's right. It's probably a huge feature there. But you know what? You can't, unless Marty McFly comes back in a DeLorean and, you know, we can't time travel, right? Yeah. So all that you've got now is I've got X dollars in capital today, whether that's in shares or cash or whatever. I can press a few buttons and turn it into cash. And it's about how that goes forward. And there's a lot of bank investors who did extremely well over the preceding 20-year period 10 years ago to have had awful returns for the last 10 years because they tried to avoid a tax liability. So it sort of proves my point here that yes, you know, absolutely factor it in. But because you were so focused on having to pay a bit of a tax bill, you've had 10 years of really shitty returns.
Yeah.
Sorry, can I say that word? I've done it. It's out
That's
there.
Okay. No, we're not claiming to be completely clean. We just try and keep it a little bit clean, but you can go there.
Apologies.
Yeah. You're passionate, mate. I like it. I like it a lot.
Yeah. So I think all is that. The other part of that question is, of course, is like let's theoretically, hypothetically assume that it is a factor.
Mm.
What's the practical outcome of that? So there's a lot of interesting things out on markets and economies and stuff where it's like, oh yeah, this is a thing, but does it offer any practical value in terms of informing your investment decisions or anything like that?
Yeah.
Probably not. So I think I really congratulate Craig for raising. I think it's a really fascinating point, but I also think it's sort of like, yeah, that's interesting, but I don't know how I fold that into my investing process.
Yeah. I guess the argument might be that if you've, you know, the possibility or probability of a winning stock going down, maybe less than others. Maybe it's safer to own a stock that's been up if he was right. I mean, I can imagine that, you know, if I'm thinking about how that might impact, you know, if he's thinking like that, he's thinking, well, I'm not going to do it. Other people might neither. So do I need to be really that worried about an overvalued stock? If everyone's going to hold it because they always have, does that give me some downside protection? I think that's a reasonable question. Maybe a gutsy question. We certainly talked about a couple of stocks that have had big falls despite their success. I mean, Kogan went from 3 to 30 and is now back at 12. So maybe that's exhibit one. But I really do think he's right to some degree. I do think that banks are more expensive than they would be if everyone was forced to sell their bank stocks, and then you know they changed the names of the banks, but kept the financials the same. Said, "Do you want to invest in this business?" I dare say you'd have maybe a quarter, a tenth of the interest in those businesses if you gave them the same financials, the same market position. Everything else was the same except you hadn't had the stock history with it. If it'd never been listed, it was going public now at $80, $85, we'd be falling over ourselves to put 25% of our portfolios in a Commonwealth Bank. I very, very much doubt it, right? But we convince ourselves that there's something there, and the retail investor love for these things. I'm reasonably sure he's pretty right, mate. That you know the amount of love is correlated to the amount of money that people have made on it, and their reluctance to sell is, again, do you do anything with it? Probably not. But you and I probably would have been more right in the past if it hadn't been true, right? If people had genuinely judged on
that's
their
true.
Merits,
yeah.
I dare say the bank share prices would be lower today.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Yeah, as I say, I don't know what I do with it, so yeah. I'm not gonna buy something that I feel is overvalued, even if that is a consideration.
Very good. Anyway, welcome back.
What's the next one
from strawman.com? We are very pleased to have you, and you're going to hang around for a mailbag episode on Sunday, right?
Oh, you bet, man. Yeah, you bet.
I'm not short of an opinion. I did all this research, but you may not know this is a very, very special regular mailbag edition that we only very specially do every now and again on Sundays. So that's the running joke. You'll have to get used to that one.
I'll catch up on that one between
episodes. In the meantime, please do subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast. Do it through iTunes, your favorite Android podcast app, or the new listener app from the good people at Southern Cross Austereo that we're affiliated with and who produce this podcast for us. If you like what we're doing, please give us a rating on iTunes. 5 stars would be lovely. Do it for Andrew. The guy's coming back. He's having some, I won't say concerns. I won't say he's worried. I won't say his ego is threatened. All I'm saying is try and do the right thing, please, for Andrew. Just be a good sport. Look after Andrew. Give him some love. Give him 5 stars on the podcast just to make him feel better. It'll help him along. Trust me.
If we get anything less than 5 stars, I'm out. I'm walking. Okay.
Don't say that. We'll lose listeners all over the joint.
Perfection or bust.
There you go, Phil. Don't let Andrew down, please. And of course, do tell your friends. If you want a dose of foolishness and some marketing straight to your inbox, go to fool.com.au/MMM. And of course, check out Andrew at strawman.com. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll see you on Sunday with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
See you later.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.